And now we turn to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Here's what's next in Utah's disputed redistricting process, now that lawmakers have adopted a map. Highlights from the Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Dallin Oaks takes church reins, steps away from a Russell Nelson tradition. And feds put a polarizing Southern Utah highway proposal back on the table months after the Biden administration rejected it. Later in the program, we'll hear from Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley and reporter Brooke Larson. Right now, we bring in Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, good morning, Tom.
Good morning. So we want to talk about redistricting. The headline here is what's next. There's been a lot happening in a kind of a short amount of time. Your story is divided into subsections with questions. That's especially convenient for me. I'll just ask these questions. What sparked this tussle over redistricting?
Right. As we talked about on the show, it seems like it's one of these things that where there's these long breaks where there's nothing that happens and it all happens at once. And we had one of those weeks this week where it all happened at once. But the background is back in 2018, voters approved the Better Boundaries Initiative. And part of that was it created an independent redistricting commission, and it prohibited partisan gerrymandering, where the districts are drawn to benefit one party over the other. The legislature didn't like that. They essentially repealed key parts of that bill, made the redistricting commission pretty toothless, and took out the prohibition on partisan gerrymandering. Last year, the Utah Supreme Court said that that violated the Constitution, because if citizens have a constitutional right to alter and reform government through the ballot measures, that right becomes meaningless if the legislature just can go back in and undo it. So they said that they have to give some due respect to that. It can only do it under, you know, if there's a compelling state interest in changing the initiative law. In August, Judge Diana Gibson, after after hearing from both parties, said that no, there's not a compelling state interest to have repealed the law. So the law goes back into effect, and that means they have to draw the new boundaries again, because the boundaries they drew didn't comply with the Better Boundaries Initiative Proposition 4. So that's the legislature was on a tight time frame to get that that map done. They had a couple hearings a few weeks ago where they took public comment, and they produced five maps from the Republican side. The Democrats also submitted one map and had a 10-day public comment period. On Monday, the Legislative Redistricting Committee met and chose option C, one of the five maps that they had put forward. And the legislature in a special session on Monday adopted that one. So that is the map that was submitted to the court. That doesn't mean this process is over yet. The judge is still going to look at the maps and look at the map that the legislature submitted and decide if it now complies with Proposition 4. And if it does, that's the map that will be used in 2026. If not, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, League of Women Voters and Mormon Women for Ethical Government, have also submitted two maps that the judge can consider and choose the one that she thinks best complies with the initiative.
Map C, and you did some analysis, right, the Tribune, on these maps. Map C is the map least likely to result in a Democrat regaining a seat. What are some of the numbers there?
Yeah, all five of the maps are better for Democrats than the current structure, than the ones that have been in place since 2021. But Map C is the one that's least likely to yield a Democrat seat. The closest seat is about a 6-point Republican advantage. And that's, you got to take that with a little bit of, the 6-point thing is based on past election performances by a Republican and Democrat. So we're looking at presidential races, gubernatorial races, U.S. Senate races mainly. But when you include those presidential races, Donald Trump didn't do well in Utah in 2016, 2020, or 2024. So that brings it down a little bit. It's probably a couple points better for an average Republican or, say, a Spencer Cox Republican. But 6 is what the average comes down to. So that's, you know, that's an improvement over about 20-point advantage that Republicans have in each of the four districts now. But it still could be challenging for some Democrats. Now, a Democrat like Ben McAdams, who's won congressional seats in the past, he's won in districts that are more like 13 or 14 points. So it can be done, but it is, like I said, the most challenging of the five maps that were put on the table. And just briefly, I'll kind of describe what the map is. You've got sort of a northern Utah District 1, then you've got Salt Lake County that's kind of split into an east and west, and the eastern part goes with Summit County, the northern part of Utah County, and off down through the eastern counties down to the southern tip. And then you've got the western part of Salt Lake County that gets combined with Tooele County, and then you've got a sort of a southwestern Utah district that is everything south of Tooele County, down to sort of I-15 is sort of the dividing line.
The current map splits the county, Salt Lake County, to four, right? And this one would split it into two.
Yeah, the current map kind of had this little point in Mill Creek where you where all four counties basically came together within about a mile and a half radius. And so that's what the Democrats didn't like, and that's what the League of Women Voters sued over, is that by splitting Salt Lake County and putting it in with the rural counties, you've diluted the voice of the Salt Lake County voters, the more progressive voters in the state, and ensured that Republicans have four safe Republican seats. This one, like you mentioned, only splits Salt Lake County, and the only other county that actually gets a little bit divided is the northern part of Utah County goes in with, like I said, that district that's the eastern part of Salt Lake County.
What do the plaintiffs' maps look like?
The plaintiffs' maps, one of them is, I guess you'd call it a donut hole. It's the northern roughly two-thirds of Salt Lake County. And that just fits it neatly into one district. It's a very progressive leaning district. I think it was about a 17-point Democrat advantage in that district. So that would be a pretty safe Democrat seat. The other map looks similar to the map the legislature adopted, but the way it divides the eastern part of the state, removing Sandy and West Jordan, putting it into the eastern part of the eastern district, makes that western district just lean a little bit Democrat toward Democratic candidates. But aside from that, it's not dissimilar. The northern and southwestern districts are essentially the same.
So I think it was Senator Brammer, he said if the judge, if I remembered this correctly, the judge chooses one of the plaintiff maps, he'll consider that malfeasance. That's a loaded word. That's a significant word.
Yeah, so this is where things get kind of interesting, right? The legislature said repeatedly on Monday, legislative leaders, that they don't like this process that they're being forced to go through. They think the judge is overstepping her authority and requiring them to do it. They are doing it under protest, but Senator Brammer said that if the and Speaker Schultz frankly reiterated this, if the judge chooses a map that wasn't drawn by the legislature, that violates the legislature's constitutional duty to draw the maps. The Utah Constitution says the legislature shall draw the boundaries. And he thinks if the judge chooses one that's not their map, then she's overstepping her authority, and that constitutes malfeasance in office. He also said that if the lieutenant governor, who's a top state elections official, certifies a map that wasn't drawn by the legislature, that also is malfeasance in office. And the significance of that phrase, malfeasance in office, is that is the grounds for impeachment of either a judge or the lieutenant governor. So it was a not very veiled threat to the judge that, if she were to choose one of the plaintiff's maps, there could be repercussions. And so, she's got a hearing scheduled on the 23rd and 24th, where she'll hear from the parties about they have experts who are analyzing the maps, and she'll hear arguments from them about which map they think that should be chosen, and then make her decision before November 10th. They've got to have it in place by November 10th, so the elections officials can prepare for candidate filings in January.
Judge Gibson said that in her ruling, Proposition 4 is the law of the land, and so what remind us what the criteria are? That's what she's going to be using, I think, to determine a map.
Correct. Some of them are pretty standard criteria. They want the the boundaries to be contiguous, which means, you know, there's they can be driven across fairly easily. They want them to be compact as possible. That gets tricky, obviously, when you're dealing with rural counties, because to get the population numbers you need, you got to include large swaths of land. They have to have equal numbers of people in them or close to it. And then it gets a little bit trickier. There's they want to avoid splits of counties and cities. They want to keep communities of interest intact, and how they define that is it kind of varies a little bit. But you know, generally speaking, one of them that the Republican legislators were pretty focused on was military bases. You know, that they consider that a community of interest. Or you know, the Ute Reservation, for example, they want to keep that in one district. So that's one of the criteria. And then you have this partisan bias, this challenge that it shouldn't favor or disfavor one party. And that gets a little subjective. The legislature tried to put some tests. The legislature, the Republican legislature, designated three tests that the judge can use for that. We don't want to go into all of that here, but basically these are mathematical formulas that academics have put forth to kind of say, here's how you can put a test through this formula and determine if it's a partisan gerrymander or not. Now, the plaintiffs in the lawsuit don't like the three tests they chose. They actually say that they were probably the worst possible test that they could choose for a state like Utah that only has four districts and has a largely dominant Republican Party. They work better in some districts where you have 13 or 14 seats and it's a little bit more competitive. But they said in Utah, the way they've structured it, it would actually ensure that that competitive or Democrat-leaning maps are fail the test, whereas the seats that favor four Republican seats are the only ones that can pass. So they went to the judge. They filed within hours of that test bill being signed into law. Arguing to the judge that this bill, these tests are essentially a way to nullify that partisan gerrymandering provision in Proposition 4, which the Supreme Court said that they can't do. And so they're asking the judge to throw that, to strike down that bill, use the tests that she thinks are appropriate, rather than these three that have been designated by the legislature. So we'll see how that goes. They've got, again, this is on a tight time frame. They're asking the judge to make a decision on that before, I believe, the 21st of this month. So just within the next week and a half or so. Again, very tight time frame, and that will make a big difference, I think, in how the judge analyzes these maps, because if she leaves that bill in place and can only use the three maps, you are going to end up with this map C that the legislature passed, passing those three tests and then being the map. If she decides not to use that and decides there are other better tests that should be used, then it's an open question, I guess, whether map C passes muster under those.
So once the Judge Gibson rules, say she rules in a way the legislature doesn't like, and will they take it to the Utah Supreme Court? Is that where this is heading eventually?
So several of the legislators, Senator Scott Sandel, who was the co-chair of the redistricting committee, the Senate President Stuart Adams, they all said that they intend to pursue an appeal to the Utah Supreme Court and potentially to the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't say when they would do that, and so because this deadline is November 10th, they may be under a tight deadline to do that. But they have made the threat that they would appeal, but they haven't done that yet. They did appeal earlier. The judge putting this tight timeline on it and the order to redraw the maps, but the court rejected that. So, you know, that's another avenue that the legislature can take if they don't like the outcome, and one that they have said that they will definitely be taking.
So whatever map is chosen is probably going to be more favorable, at least a couple of these districts, to Democrats than it has been before. Might attract more interest from different Democrats. You mentioned former Representative Ben McAdams. Who else might have some interest here?
Yeah, Ben is not saying that he would run again, but people close to him are saying he's looking at it, looking at the possibility. State Senator Kathleen Riebe on Monday put out a statement that said she's considering running because she would be in that sort of eastern district on the eastern side of the split of Salt Lake County, and says that she thinks that she can win and that there are important policies that she wants to pursue. The other thing that's going to be kind of interesting is if we do have a competitive race in the state, it starts bringing in a lot more national money. And I think that it's likely that especially if there's a competitive race, there would be a lot of national money flowing in on both sides of the equation. And it's probably important to kind of keep in mind the why this matters, the consequences of this. We've got a narrowly divided U.S. House right now. It's six seats. There's a Democrat who's waiting to be sworn in that would make it five. And that's a hard margin in that in a House of 435 representatives to navigate, to implement policy with. So that makes it that, so it matters because of that. It also matters because in the midterm election, the party in power in the White House usually loses seats. So if Republicans lose seats, again, even just a few seats, it could they lose control of the chamber, and that means they lose that Democrats would then have the power to investigate the administration, issue subpoenas, and so forth. It means it's even harder for the Republicans to implement their policy decisions. And also, we keep in mind that the Democrats have impeached President Trump twice. Impeachment starts in the House. It doesn't mean that it would get through the Senate almost certainly, but that would be on the table again as well. So there is a lot riding on, every seat matters in the 2026 election, and that's why there's a lot of interest locally and nationally in how this Utah process plays out.
Finally, this very quickly, what about other political boundaries? Utah House, Utah Senate, Board of Education maps?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in theory, the state Senate, state House, and U Utah State School Board seats all should have been drawn under this Better Boundaries Initiative standards now as well. They weren't, but nobody's challenged those. So those will stay in place through the 2026 election. Could somebody come in and file a lawsuit and challenge those? Yes, perhaps. And I would likely have a pretty good case to be made based on the precedent that's been set with these congressional boundaries. But as it stands right now, the only boundaries that have been voided and need to be redrawn are the congressional boundaries. So that's where that one stands right now.
All right. I'm sure you'll be keeping an eye on this as it moves forward. When talking with Salt Lake Tribune politics reporter Robert Gerke. Robert, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom.
Before we go to another break, just wanted to mention again, Craig Johnson, author of the Longmire series, popular author, is in Logan. He'll be at the Logan Library tonight at 6. You have an opportunity, if you're in northern Utah, to go and see him. Space is limited, so it's free, but you do have to register by going to the Logan Library's website. Again, Craig Johnson, I had a chance to interview him. You'll hear that on Access Utah on Monday. Following a break, we'll be talking about the General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We'll be talking with Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. You are listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. We bring in now Salt Lake Tribune religion reporter Tamara Kemsley. Tamara, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we want to review the General Conference of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which happened over the weekend. I guess I'll just ask you an open-ended question first. What any particular themes stand out to you from the conference this time?
You know, it was not one of the more thematic conferences, in my opinion. There were some duplicate talks, some recurring phrases and themes, but it didn't seem to coalesce the way that some conferences do. Lots of reference, of course, to temple worship and the need to be peacemakers, which has been an ongoing theme introduced by the late President Nelson. There's been a lot of, or there was a lot of emphasis on making space for others and the family, and but not, I would say, in short, no particular theme.
This was a fairly historic conference in that President Nelson died quite soon before conference. And President Oaks, next in line, chose to go forward with conference as president of the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and not form a new First Presidency.
Yeah, it was about, I think it was six days before the first day of conference was scheduled. President Nelson passed away. And it has happened before that they have held general conference without a presiding prophet, without a president, but it is rare. And so, yes, this was significant historically in that respect. Unsurprisingly, the one who stepped in to fill that those shoes as sort of presiding over the two-day event was President Oaks, who is all but certain to be confirmed as the president of the church. And we're not exactly sure when, but probably the next week. The funeral of President Nelson was yesterday. And so it's, that should be, that is going to be taking place soon. But no, he was not installed during the conference, but did take on to much of those leadership roles. And I think also began to show a little glimpse of what President Oaks, prophet of the church, might look like. He immediately announced that there would be no new temples. That was one of the more meaningful moments, I think, of the conference. Every conference under Nelson's reign, there were often a dozen or more temples announced. He announced 200, exactly 200, in his leadership that lasted from starting in 2018 to just last week. And President Oaks, and he is referred to President Oaks currently, I should note, for it's all, there's a lot of bureaucracy that goes on here, but he is a member of the First Presidency. And so even though he is not currently president of the church, he holds the title president. It's confusing, but Oaks just, screeching halt to that historic temple building spree. We also saw a bit more personal side to Oaks that we have not seen before. He's a stern lecture type apostle. He is a lawyer, a judge, a former professor, and that is often the sort of posture he assumes at the pulpit. But there was some, attempts at humor, some tears even, as he reflected on, for example, the passing of his father when he was a young child. And that continued into his remarks when he spoke at Nelson's funeral yesterday. It was one of the only times, maybe the only time, I watched Oaks speak and really get laughs. He was, some humor and injected into his remarks as he reflected on Nelson, whom he called his best friend, and also kind of sort of intimate look. As one friend of mine said, you don't often think of Oaks as having a best friend. And here he was sort of jovially remembering this man that he clearly loved. So we're, I think, starting with conference and going into yesterday, we were one of the more significant takeaways for me personally between those two events is I'm a little intrigued. Are we going to see more of this more personal side now that Oaks is taking up the top leadership position?
Just an aside, you did a report on the funeral, just to reference the funeral. One of the kind of the things that stood out to me is President Oaks eulogizing his best friend and predecessor, Russell M. Nelson. He referenced their professions. He said it referenced a time when, about 8 years ago when President Nelson took over as the president, and a mile a minute, of course, He said, as a surgeon, you got to do it right now, right? As a lawyer, you can ask for a continuance. I thought that was a fun part of that eulogy.
Yeah, that was, he talked about how he buttoned up his, tightened up his belt, metaphorically speaking, and thought, this is going to be fun. Mm-hmm. And that got the crowd kind of, I think almost because there's as much shock that Oakes was kind of making this remark as much as the remark itself. It was like, oh. So yeah, I know exactly the moment you're talking about.
There were several references to the tragedy in Michigan, right, and urging toward peacemaking. Also, a related theme. Apostle Garrett Gong said, "Let's accommodate. Let's bring in everybody, right? Not simply accommodate or tolerate, but unify."
Yeah, and Gong also specifically mentioned migrants. And how, as more and more individuals are on the move, migrating to different countries, that has led to the spread of the church message, and, you know, viewed that migration in sort of that positive missionary light. I think that it was almost surprising just how little reference, however, there was to the Michigan attack, the attack on the Michigan congregation that left 4 dead, 8 injured, 5 dead if you include the shooter. It was mentioned right off the bat by Apostle Elder Stevenson, but he quickly kind of moved on, and then it didn't really come up any other time. Yes, Stevenson called on members to be peacemakers in light of the attack. But like I said, he kind of quickly pivoted away. And that is also just kind of the tenor of General Conference, is that it very rarely gets into current events. If it does so often in oblique ways that are sort of meant to be sort of tacitly understood, like when President Oakes, you know, spent a lot of time talking about the Constitution after the attack on the Capitol, the January 6th attack, but he didn't necessarily mention any particular party or group or political movement or ideology when he did so. And likewise, you know, we heard things about migrants and accommodating everyone, but not necessarily anything about current policies that are taking effect in the United States or elsewhere.
Another speech or talk that stood out, Apostle Ronald Rasband, he says the proclamation on the family is doctrine. There's been some discussion, some people saying, well, that might change. Elder Rasband is saying, no, that's not going to change.
Yeah, and that is the document that lays out the ideal family and family relations and gender norms. It is dates back to 1994, came in response to what was then efforts by Hawaii to potentially legalize gay marriage, and came under the leadership of President Gordon B. Hinckley, and has been never canonized. And so it kind of exists, but is often cited, often used as a sort of litmus test for fidelity to the faith, and is hung in homes. You can buy different versions of it, like on Etsy, to advertise in your home. And so it's really, like, both culturally and theologically, this very touchstone document. Him declaring it doctrine won't necessarily seem all that new or surprising, I think, for many who already consider it such. Is this, however, a lead up to it being canonized and formally introduced as part of the Latter-day Saints scripture? Is the question. And some have wondered if President Oakes would seek to do that. He is someone who has made the traditional gender normative family, a touchstone of his ministry and his focus and his sermons, particularly in the last decade plus. And so if it were to happen, many believe it would happen under Oaks.
You point out three women gave speeches in this conference. I don't know if that's more or less than usual.
On par.
Yeah. On par. Okay. All right.
Kind of the on par.
Yeah. One thing that not so much what they said, but President Eyring and President Holland. President Holland appeared with an oxygen tube, and both of those gentlemen arriving and departing in wheelchairs kind of highlights those would be the kind of the two most senior that could be chosen for the first presidency, but health problems with both of those men.
Yeah, it's just an old bunch. You look at them, there's a lot of shuffling. There's a lot of, Elder Holland, he's 84, 85, either 84 or 85. He was wearing an oxygen mask. That was not the first time he'd been seen in an oxygen mask. I think President Eyring gave he's 85. He gave his sermon from a seat, if I remember correctly, and certainly has before. And then even Dieter F. Uchsdorf, who is usually just like this picture of health and vitality, was looking a little bit older this time around. He's also 85. And so you have, just an aging group. Oaks is 93, so he will be ascending to the top leadership position at the same age that Nelson was when Nelson took up the mantle of prophet and president. And it will be interesting to see, you know, many thought that this was going to be a short presidency given the age. It was not. It wasn't particularly long, but it certainly came, lasted a number of years and came with a lot of changes. And I think the question is, do we see something similar with Oaks, and how many seats, new faces, is he able to seat in the quorum? Because much like, you know, a president of, and I'm speaking of a political president, you know, in the United States, filling Supreme Court justices, a new apostle is called under a president, yes, in conversation with the other top leaders, the rest of the quorum, but ultimately is his decision and is for life, and is thus seen as who they choose is seen as a defining part of their legacy. And so how many seats will Oaks end up filling is a big question as well.
Well, we've reached the end of our time for this segment. We will urge people to go read another couple of stories from Tamara Kemsley. Here's the headlines: Active Latter-day Saints Increasingly Abandoning Orthodox Views. Very interesting article. And after Michigan attacks, some Latter-day Saints ask, why can't we take guns to church? So go and read those articles, as well as her report on the General Conference. Religion reporter Tamara Kemsley has been with us. Thank you so much.
Yep, have a good one.
And coming up next, following a break on Behind the Headlines, we're going to be talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. We'll be talking about a controversial proposed highway near St. George that appears to be back on. We'll talk about that following a break. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. More following this. You're listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. And in this part of the program, we are going to be talking with reporter Brooke Larson. Brooke, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So this is interesting development. It's developed over time. Here's the headline. Feds put polarizing Southern Utah highway proposal back on the table months after the Biden administration rejected it. So which highway are we talking about?
Yeah, so this is the Northern Corridor, a northern highway through in Washington County that's been proposed to go through the Red Cliffs National Conservation Area.
So therein lies a rub, I guess, right? Environmental groups don't want that. What are their objections?
Yeah, so this is habitat for the desert tortoise, which is a threatened species. And, you know, as this conservation area was designated in part to protect their habitat. And so the conservation groups are concerned about threats to the tortoise, as well as just the precedent this might set of building a highway through a national conservation area. This area has also experienced wildfires in recent years, so there's concern that will, you know, further diminish or impair this habitat, and as well as the potential issues post-fire, as well as the road spreading noxious weeds, things like that.
So what does Washington County want this? What's, I guess, the... Where is this situated? And I guess it's going to ease traffic if it's built.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you've been to St. George, you may have seen the cliffs, the Red Cliffs, you know, on the edge of downtown. So this conservation area really goes towards the, you know, the edge of downtown. And so this road would be north of, you know, currently the parkway that goes kind of along the southern end of the conservation area. It would just be a bit north of that, a bit north of Pioneer Park, which is a popular trailhead in the reserve. So this is really to, on the county side, to provide another road option between I-15 and State Route 18. There's Commissioner Adam Snow told me there's, you know, kind of this pinch point buildup in between current exits around I-15, and that with projected development, this is needed to move people across this part of Washington County.
There's an interesting photograph here in the story. There's a neighborhood and then nothing. This is the very edge, I guess, of St. George. Is that because it's butting up against the conservation area here?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, Washington County is developing rapidly. Population has grown significantly in recent years, and, you know, projections show that that development will continue. So this is one of, you know, I would say many places in Washington County where we're seeing this development come up against these conservation areas or popular recreation spots.
So give me a bit of a history here. Part of this is we had the Biden administration, now the Trump administration, two very different views on conservation. How did things change over time?
Yeah, so this highway was approved actually in 2021 during the last days of the president Donald Trump's first term in office. But I would say even before that, the county has been really trying to get this highway on the map, going back even to 2006, and groups like Conserve Southwest Utah, which started out, you know, as Citizens for Dixie's Future, and eventually became Conserve Southwest Utah, have been fighting this proposal for a long time. But formally, the Bureau of Land Management and the Fish and Wildlife Service considered the Utah Department of Transportation's application for a right-of-way in 2018, and that went through, you know, the National Environmental Policy Act review to determine whether or not they'd grant that right-of-way, and they decided to do that. Conserve Southwest Utah and several groups sued, and ultimately that led to the Bureau of Land Management and Fish and Wildlife Service revisiting their decision to approve this highway. They reversed that decision at the end of the Biden administration in December 2024, so less than a year ago, and now it's back on the table. So, you know, from the federal agencies, there's been quite a bit of back and forth, and now on Friday of last week, they reopened this environmental review process and have listed the preferred alternative, essentially being the, what they approved in 2021.
Now, I'm reading from your story. One key factor here is the an alternative route that had been proposed, Red Hills Parkway Expressway. Mm-hmm. Now UDOT is saying that that is not feasible.
Yes, that is what has been said in the BLM's environmental analysis and what was released on Friday. There's some details into that. I'd say, you know, Conserve Southwest Utah in their statements to me have said that they feel it, the information BLM has provided on that's inadequate. There was some details in the environmental analysis that UDOT has said, you know, what was proposed won't meet Federal Highway Administration requirements for, say, on-ramps and off-ramps, that the cost is much more expensive than was initially projected. So those are some of the concerns that has been brought up by UDOT and was the justification for reopening this analysis.
Another part of this apparently is an alternative site that would be preserved. If the northern corridor goes through, then Zone 6, which is essentially what an area called Moe's Valley, then that goes back on the table to be conserved?
Yeah, so this is kind of a complicated factor in all of this. So basically, before there was the National Conservation Area, there's been the Red Cliffs Desert Reserve, and that was an area set aside basically because the desert tortoise, a designated species that the county needed to put some action in place to protect that under the Endangered Species Act. And so under their latest application, it's kind of wonky, complicated, but they have to put in an application called an incident take permit. And that, you know, just acknowledges that because of development in Washington County, some desert tortoise may be lost, but here's what the county is going to do to try and protect habitat and, you know, minimize that as much as possible. And so one proposal they put in there, in that plan, their habitat conservation plan, was if the Northern Corridor is approved, does go forward, then they, you know, will work with other entities, the State Trust Lands Administration, you know, notable landowner in this Zone 6 Moe's Valley area, to conserve that, to add that as part of this larger reserve. And so that has kind of been this issue that's put recreation users at odds with some conservationists because it, you know, has been a path to protect this really popular recreation site that technically, yes, is known as Zone 6. That's because this desert reserve is divided into different zones. So it would just be adding in an additional zone to the reserve. But yeah, it adds an interesting layer to this fight because, you know, usually we do see environmental groups and recreation users kind of on the same side, and it's created a bit of division.
In the meantime, you report that Conserve Southwest Utah thinks you ought to protect Moe's Valley and Red Cliffs National Conservation Area. It shouldn't have to pick.
Yep. Yeah, that is one of their big arguments, that this proposal put forward by the county and that the, you know, federal government accepted and with the habitat conservation plan. And when they did designate that highway and did approve that right away in 2021, that deal did essentially go through until they reconsidered it. That it is essentially the Conserve Southwest Utah has said that is a temporary protection. You know, these habitat conservation plans last 25 years. So what Conserve Southwest Utah has put out is that is temporary, not permanent in protection. But I've also heard from recreation users that they haven't heard or seen meaningful progress from groups like Conserve Southwest Utah in protecting it. And so it's, you know, seems quite challenging from what I'm hearing on the ground. This is potentially highly valuable land. The Trust Lands Administration could, you know, develop this for a lot of money. And so for conservation groups to rally, say, you know, a private landowner to put a conservation easement or something like that, has been challenging from what I'm hearing from sources. But there are certainly pathways that, you know, groups could pursue for permanent protection. It just seems like there hasn't been a ton of movement on that.
Now, Washington County, back when this was not going in the direction they hoped it would, they filed a lawsuit. What's the status of that lawsuit?
Yeah, they decided to dismiss that lawsuit for the time being. And they've said the reason for that is because they've had good conversations with federal agencies in recent months. So, yeah, they dismissed that in late September. And, you know, the county is a cooperating agency on this environmental review process regarding the Northern Corridor. So they, from what I've heard, are in pretty active conversation with the agencies around this.
Can the public still weigh in on this?
Yeah, the public can weigh in until November 3rd. That's the final date that the public comment will be open on the Bureau of Land Management's planning website.
And you've got a link to where you can go to comment in your story. Mm-hmm. So we'll urge people to go to Brooke Larson's story at sltrib.com. We just have a couple of minutes here in this segment. I want to talk about the shutdown, how that's affecting national parks. You and your colleague Mark Eddington had a story on this when the government first shut down about a week or so ago. I guess the takeaway from this is national parks are open, but there may be some services that aren't going to be available.
Yeah, so I'd also encourage people to go to reporting from colleagues at Moab Times as well that we republish on the TRIB's website to get some of the takes from Arches National Park. They've been doing some great on-the-ground reporting too. It's from what we've seen, you know, park rangers are pretty limited in what they can provide to the public. You know, colleague in Moab overheard a conversation between a visitor and a park ranger where they said essentially they could only give information on fire safety because, you know, fire suppression has been deemed an essential duty that the Park Service is keeping on. The state has stepped in to keep visitor centers open, as well as some of the nonprofit partners to parks, such as Zion Forever Project down in Springdale. So it's the services are limited. You know, they're not able to collect fees, things like that. So financial resources from these nonprofit partners and the state are helping keep some of the basics open.
And then in your story, you mentioned that there are regular updates on visitutah.com, the state's.
Yeah, I believe it's, let me just, I'll confirm that for you. Yeah, visitutah.com.
Yeah. They're doing some updating as well. Of course, check in with the Tribune and also the Times Independent as well. Mm-hmm. We've been talking with Salt Lake Tribune reporter Brooke Larson. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
And you've been listening to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from Utah Public Radio and the Salt Lake Tribune. I'm Tom Williams. Hope you'll be with us again next time.